Hi, I'm Rod Kurtz, and you're listening to the third and final installment of the Best of Blueprint Alberta H2O. Blueprint H2O has been a three-week series where CBC Radio took an in-depth look at Alberta's water. Are we good stewards of the resource? And is our water future crystal clear? This week, we look at one of the water wasters in your home. It's not the toilet. And we'll let you hear some of your feedback. Listeners have been writing in, responding to what they're hearing on Blueprint H2O. What sort of a commodity is water in the marketplace? And how may that marketplace look in the future? We'll try to answer those and other questions this week on the Best of Blueprint Alberta H2O. Calgary and Edmonton are booming, but the rivers that give them water are shrinking. So we ask the simple question, why? Reporter Aaron Collins attempts to answer that question with Jim Brown, the host of CBC Calgary's Eye Opener.
So, first of all, what's causing our rivers to shrink?
Yeah, it's a couple things. And first of all, we are living in a boom time. Everyone around here knows that. And everything we do needs water. So when you have more people doing more things, of course, they're going to take more water. So there's this huge increase in demand from individuals and industry here. And secondly, we're seeing some serious changes in the area of the province that sort of fills our rivers, and that being the Rocky Mountains. Basically, what we have is a warming climate. It's melting our glaciers, reducing the amount of snow we get, which in turn means less water hits our rivers. So to give you an idea of how much we're losing and how fast, the snowpack in the Rockies is down about 20 to 25% over the last two decades, and Glacier National Park is going to be glacier-free in 15 years. I talked to Peter Glick. He's with the Pacific Institute, a California-based water research center, and here's how he describes the impact of climate change here.
Climate change is a real problem. Humans are causing it, and among the worst impacts will be impacts on water. When we get it, how much we get, the timing of it. And Alberta is a classic example of a place that's going to be very, very sensitive to climate change because of rising temperatures, because of Alberta's dependence on snowfall and snowpack and glacial runoff. And institutionally, we are not thinking about climate change properly yet.
Okay, Aaron, if we're glacier-free in 15 years, mm-hmm. how is that going to affect us down here in the cities?
Yeah, glaciers really don't provide a huge amount of our water, but they're sort of like a really, really important bank account for water that releases like that extra shot of water in the really warm, dry months when demand for water rises. Of course, we use a lot more water in the summer than we do in the winter because we're watering our lawns, we're irrigating our crops, we're using swimming pools. All those things happen in the summer, and these glaciers release that extra shot we really need when things heat up. So you have to remember as well that it's not like we can use every bit of water that flows by. We've got to share it with our neighbors. I talked to Brian Marr of Trout Unlimited about this as we drove around checking out the levels of the Bow and the Elbow west of Calgary.
We also have to remember that 50% of the South Saskatchewan River Basin is allocated to Saskatchewan.
Yeah.
So we have to, we're the headwater. We're the top of the chart here, and I think that we have to realize that there's a lot of responsibility that goes along with that.
Okay, how long do we have until these shortages start to hit us?
Yeah, soon, really, really soon. I think sooner than most people would expect. And I'm going to give you an example here. I'm going to use Calgary as an example. Steve Grasby is a scientist with the Geological Survey of Canada. He just finished a report that says if we don't change our ways significantly, Calgary's not going to have enough water to meet its needs in 10 to 15 years. Basically, Grasby says that because of that cap on new water licenses on the Bow Basin, we're not going to have any more water than we do now, which is about 1,000 million liters a day or 1,000 megaliters a day, as the experts like to say. But he says Alberta's getting warmer. The warmer the weather, the more water we use, that whole summer thing. And at a certain point, demand is going to be greater than supply.
In the summer, in the last few years, we've been getting days that we're starting to reach those really hot summer days where we're now approaching the limit of what the city can supply to meet the demand. And as we see the population growing in the future and climate change creating more of these warm days where we have high demand, essentially we're going to be crossing that barrier where the demand of the people of Calgary will exceed what the city can withdraw from the river to supply that.
So if we could have a water shortage in 10 to 15 years, what's being done about this today?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot of things that are being done as far as government level and people, individuals trying to change their patterns and stuff. But I think the most important thing that has to be done is leadership has to be taken by government to really implement new programs to address this. I spoke to Sekou Toure, who's with the United Nations Environment Program in Kenya. And this is a place where water scarcity, of course, is already a big issue. And what he says is he sees a lot of similarities between Alberta and his part of the world. And he says that in order to avoid a crisis here in the near future, government really has to act now.
The case of the Nile or Jordan may seem far away from Canada or from Calgary or from Banff. But you see, you have to have a proper institutions in place. You have to have a set of rules to govern how the resources are going to be shared. So at the core of any major water problem is a governance issue.
What about the steps government has already taken?
Yeah, we have heard about that throughout this program as well. We have heard about the moratorium on new licenses on the South Saskatchewan Basin, and that's a really good idea, but the question sort of is whether or not it's a bit too late or not. And then, of course, we've also heard about the big Water for Life plan, which is Alberta's water conservation strategy. It really hasn't been adequately funded by the Klein government, according to critics. So these moves maybe leave a bit to be desired if we're heading towards a real crisis in a decade. Now, of course, the government doesn't really see it as an imminent crisis. They envision it more as sort of a manageable difficulty. Here's how Alberta's Environment Minister Guy Boutillier sees it.
There is ample opportunity for capacity over the years to come. But can we do better? Yes. And I think it's an attitude that Albertans have. And I think they support the attitude that we can do better by better conservation methods. Our Water for Life strategy, where our target is to have a 30% improvement in water management by the year 2015. So that allows even greater opportunities for towns such as Brooks and for others that are growing. So we have to strike this balance of protecting our basin, but at the same time allowing economic development to take place. And I think we're striking that right balance.
Okay, well, Guy Boutillier says government is doing its part. What about individuals?
Yeah. Well, he mentioned that 30% improvement, and I think individuals are going to have a big role in that. And there is a lot of room for change. We've heard that Europeans use about half as much water as we do, but there's also differences right here in the province. There's differences between Calgary and Edmonton. Edmonton uses about Edmontonians use about 260 liters per person per day. Mm-hmm. We're more like 350 down here. So I mean, there's even room for improvement here in the province. So I think individuals do have a big role to play, and we just really have to act now.
Okay. Aaron, thanks again.
All right, that's not an indicator of the direction of this program, but that is the sound of a toilet, of course. And for years, the toilet was always singled out as the water waster in the home. But now many homes have a water-efficient toilet, a water-efficient shower, but they still have the huge honking bathtub. As part of our series, Blueprint Alberta H2O, Jennifer Keene's been looking at our love affair with the tub, and she chats about that with Peter Brown, the host of CBC Edmonton's Radioactive.
So is there such a thing as a water-efficient tub?
Well, the only kind of tub that would be water-efficient really is a very small tub.
Right.
One that's only filled to half full. But as you know, Peter, small is not the trend in bathtubs right now.
No.
You know, the standard tub, the one you probably grew up with in the 60s or 70s, the steel turquoise model, mm-hmm. that was about 5 feet long and 2.5 feet wide. Today, the standard tub is still about that size, only it's deeper, and it holds about 8 to 10 imperial gallons more. But the standard tub is really no longer standard. That's according to Dennis Manns, the sales manager at Bath and Kitchen Classics here in Southeast Calgary. He doesn't even bother to sell standard tubs because his customers are all looking for a little something extra, and in some cases, a lot of extra.
The home spa is the end concept. Everybody wants a jetted tub or a hydrotherapy tub. They want usually a big shower or a steam shower. And the ensuite bathrooms now are big. Like I'm doing them 20-foot square. I just got off the phone with a guy that had a fireplace and a TV in his bathroom. So
Everybody's using them for a place to hide and relax, and rather than going to the spa, easier to do it at home.
So it's not a bathroom, it's a bachelor apartment at this point.
Pretty much. I think the first apartment I had was smaller than that.
Yes.
And it didn't have either a fireplace or a TV in it. But you know, when I was at the store, I had Dennis Manns show me the biggest tub they had, Peter, the Cadillac of tubs. It had the air jets. This is the new thing, the air jets,
right,
as opposed to the jacuzzi tub.
Oh, okay.
And it had heated backrests on both sides, because there was room for two. Because, so, you know, it's not hot enough in the tub.
Because
right?
You're 1 inch from warm water. Exactly. You could freeze out there.
Although, I don't know, the combination of what must be electricity with the water. I don't know. I didn't ask. Anyway, Dennis estimates that this tub, the Cadillac, could hold as much as 40 gallons of water. Now, compare that to the old standard tub, which would hold about 20 to 25 gallons. And, you know, before we get calls on this, I have to tell you that everyone I talked to spoke in imperial gallons instead of liters. So those are the terms I'm using.
So that's a lot of water. That's a lot of heat. How big a water heater do you need for the big unit?
Oh, you need a monster water heater. If you have a typical water heater, that's about 33 gallons. It's not even going to come close to filling one of those big luxury tubs. And Dennis Mann says he runs into customers who make this mistake all the time. They renovate their bathrooms, put in these huge luxury tubs, and then discover they can't fill them up.
They can rent them out.
Well, I guess. Well, that's why you need the heaters, I guess.
Oh, I suppose. Yes. It's a heated apartment
for
the people living with you. Now, this is something I've heard argued about for years. Which is more water efficient, a bath or a shower?
In general, a short shower, and I'm talking 5 to 10 minutes, is considered more water efficient than having a bath, especially if you have what water conservationists like to call a navy shower. That's when you turn the water on to get wet, turn it off while you lather up, and then turn it on again to rinse off. So you could call that a navy shower or just a very uncomfortable shower, either one.
But yeah, or the shower that the person didn't build their luxury bathroom so they could have.
Exactly. Now, but showers at least have water efficiency measures in the form of these low-flow shower heads. According to Dennis Manns, the new standard for shower heads in Alberta is about 2.5 gallons a minute, which is much better than it was a few years ago. But as with bathtubs, showers are becoming a luxury in homes as well.
Some of the showers they're putting in now are quite large, too, and a lot of people are putting like a 8-inch rain can type shower head in the ceiling, a bank of three body sprays in the wall, and then a handheld shower to use just as a fixed shower head or to rinse the shower off. But they have the capabilities of being able to turn on like 5 shower heads at the same time at 2.5 gallons a minute. And that's an improvement over 5 years ago, where most of them flowed at 4 or 5 gallons a minute.
So let's do the math, Peter. If you've got 5 shower heads going at 2.5 gallons a minute, that's 12.5 gallons a minute.
Yep.
Not exactly water efficient.
No.
But, you know, it's funny. I asked Dennis if any of his customers ever ask about water efficiency, and he says they only ask about efficiency in regard to the toilets, never in regard to the bath or showers. And that's because, let's face it, we love our baths and showers. We are obsessed with bathing in this culture, I would say. And to get some perspective on just how much we bathe today, I talked to a historian who's writing a book about personal hygiene, a man named Peter Ward, who teaches at the University of British Columbia. He told me a story which puts this in perspective. He said that when his grandfather was a boy, his grandfather had baths twice a year. When Peter Ward was a boy, he had a bath once a week. And his daughters had showers twice a day.
Hmm.
So, you know, it's pretty easy to see the pattern. And interestingly, he says our love of bathing may not be a natural phenomenon, but rather a result of canny marketing on the part of some big companies.
Probably the biggest push actually came from the people who merchandised soap, shampoo, deodorant, the whole range of personal care products that are available in every corner shop and every supermarket today. These were, by and large, inventions of the past half century or so, and the power of the big merchandisers who produced and sold these things, I think, has been one of the primary educational forces in the great transition of personal hygiene.
So it's all because of those Irish Spring commercials, Peter. We all want to be fresh.
And it's also because of those instructions on the shampoo bottle. You have to rinse, lather, and repeat.
It's unnecessary.
It's a lot of water.
It is a lot of water. It's put a lot of pressure on our water sources.
What sort of pressure are we talking about?
Some sources say it's the first biggest source of municipal water use. Others say it's the second. According to Alberta Environment, 35% of residential water use is due to showers and baths. And that concerns Barbara Kinney. She's the former chair of the local chapter of the Sierra Club of Canada. She and her husband moved into a new home last June, and it came with one of those big soaker tubs. Mm-hmm. She says she's used it only once since moving in because she just can't bring herself to fill it up. She says we can't just turn on the taps without thinking about the consequences.
People have to turn their thinking around. We all have to turn our thinking around. It's me too. Everyone has to turn their thinking around. And I think we need to reframe it and think about having those luxurious baths and those big soaker tubs as a privilege rather than a right. And it's something that maybe is something we do on a special occasion rather than on a regular basis so that we are conserving.
Okay, Jennifer, so we have a problem. We got the huge bathtubs, we've got the five shower heads,
yep,
and we've got less water. How are we going to conserve?
Well, as Barbara Kinney mentioned, I mean, these large tubs are fine if you only use them once in a while. And if you keep your showers to 5 or 10 minutes, then you'll lose less water than even a standard tub. But also, she'd like Alberta to start thinking about the potential for gray water usage. You know, this is a system whereby you can reuse the water from your tub in toilets or on the yard. And it's in place in cities like Austin, Texas, where they have, you know, they have issues of water supply, much like here in Calgary, for example.
Jennifer, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Peter.
This series, Blueprint H2O, has spawned a lot of discussion. It has people thinking about water, how we use or abuse it. Students in the Southeast Calgary community of Forest Lawn recently took part in a special project about water, and to celebrate what they learned, they put together a mural. They're calling it a Stream of Dreams. It represents what the students have learned about local watersheds and the environment. Reporter Angela Knight took a dip in the Stream of Dreams and shared her experience with Jim Brown.
So what does this mural look like?
It's really cool, Jim. It's a mural made up of hundreds of hand-painted wooden dream fish that over 400 kids did. And it's set up along a chain link fence. So if you're heading out of the Greater Forest Lawn area this morning, heading westbound, I want you to look to your right, mm-hmm, while keeping an eye on traffic.
Of course.
And right around 17th Avenue and 41st Street in the southeast at Holy Trinity School, the kids went out and they painted their chain link fence blue to give you sort of that sea effect. Mm-hmm. And then they put this wonderful wavy design with all of these beautiful fish set up there. Now, it's all part of this program called Stream of Dreams, which is actually based in BC. And I spoke with Joanne Carn. She's with the group. And I asked her how she got involved here in Calgary.
Well, we've been talking to people in Calgary for a while, and they've discovered that our program that connects art with environmental education fits perfectly with their efforts to raise awareness of taking care of our waterways and looking after our stormwater and beautifying our neighborhoods. So it was the local International Avenue Business Revitalization Zone. They brought the program in wanting to beautify their neighborhood and involve the community in a project at the same time as we help kids learn how to take care of water.
So what did the students learn when it came to taking care of water?
Well, they learned the basics of water conservation and things that they can do in their own neighborhood and their own homes. And I'll let a couple of the students tell us what they've learned.
Hi, this is from Natasha Soderberg from Holy Cross School. This is how you can save water by putting it into a barrel and use it instead of tap water. You can water your garden or like use it for cooking or anything what you need water for.
Kesick Summers. I've learned that you shouldn't put things that don't belong down the drains in them, like oil when you change your car, and try and wash your cars on grass instead of on the road so it drips down the drain. Whatever goes into the drain goes down to the fish.
Whatever goes down the drain goes down to the fish.
Yeah, and you can hear the background sounds. We were in the gym. They did a big thing over the lunch hour gym, and they had kids fishing in the fish pond, and they had fish-shaped cookies, and of course,
goldfish crackers. They were all running around with their goldfish crackers, and they had ball bounces. They were very, very excited. And then there was a big, long procession out to the mural. It was actually really cold at lunchtime on Friday, so the kids were all bundled up, and they actually blessed the mural. And then the kids were out there to see their handiwork all set up on the fence. So they worked really hard on it, and we hope a lot of people will drive by and take a look.
Okay, and just in case anyone missed it before, where do people see the mural?
You can see it at Holy Trinity School, so it's along 17th Avenue in the southeast, right at 41st Street.
You're listening to The Best of Blueprint Alberta H2O. I'm Rod Kurtz. We've been getting plenty of feedback to our H2O series. CBC reporter Aaron Collins shared some of our listeners' thoughts with Jennifer Keane on CBC Calgary's Eye Opener.
So who do we have first this morning?
Well, we received this message from Rob in Medicine Hat through email. It goes like this. I've enjoyed your extended series on water and look forward to hearing more. Your piece on golf courses would have benefited from a comparison with other uses of water. How many houses could be supplied with the water for each course? I was actually surprised at how little water is used. 20 million liters is about how much a 10-acre farm would use. Of course, there are very few farms this small. Most farmers irrigate 160 acres or more. As a non-golfer, I'm intrigued with the increasing acceptance of links courses. This style of course has very rough, and very small fairways with little irrigation. Hope the water issues become a regular feature on the program. So first thing that I notice is we have very, very well-informed listeners. Mm-hmm. And I want to thank Rob because I actually misspoke during my piece, and he's correct. 20 million liters is too small. It's actually 40 million liters. I blame the conversion from gallons to liters. Math is not my strong point.
Yeah.
And Rob, point well taken. Comparison is helpful. So again, math is not my strong point, but I had a few minutes. I did some calculations, and that would be about – the annual amount of water it would take to run a golf course would be the same approximately as the amount of water 300 people would need for the entire year for all their bathing and drinking water, etc. So if you extrapolate that over 300 plus courses in the province, you're looking at about 90,000 people is what the water for all of our golf courses would take care of. So
A lot. We can say
a lot. It's a good chunk.
And it's hard to compare to households because households vary in size.
Could be two people, could be eight people, could be five people.
Exactly. Yeah. It's interesting you brings up the links, you know, because I was thinking during your piece about the British Open this year where it was on television, and a lot of people were remarking on how brown the grass looks, but that's how they leave them. You know, they don't water them intensively the way we do some of them.
And that's where golf came from, right? Over there in the UK. So.
That's right. We should take a hint from them. So we also received this email. This came after your story about the ski industry and how the ski industry in Alberta could ironically actually benefit because our hills are at higher elevations.
Yeah. It's a nice spin.
Yeah, this came from Paul Davis. I listened to the story about the impact of global warming on Alberta's ski industry this morning and am troubled by the conclusion of your reporter. That's you, Aaron. It is true that in the spring, the water utilized for snowmaking does return to streams from where it was originally taken, but that does not mean that it's not detrimental to the biology of the streams. Perhaps this can be appreciated by way of analogy. Say, for example, the provincial government decided to take an extra 20% of your paycheck each week with the promise that you would get it back with your tax return in April. No net loss of money, but I suspect every Albertan would experience significant stress as a result. That's an interesting analogy.
Yeah, and again, a good point. Mm-hmm. If you talk to water experts and environmentalists, anytime you divert water, which I believe I did mention, anytime you move water around, they're not happy with it because water's sort of supposed to flow where it's supposed to flow, and it's not a good idea to move it around. My point was that generally, anything that you turn into snow and spray on the thing is it's going to melt and it's going to end up back in the water supply eventually. Yeah. But he's absolutely correct. Anytime you move stuff around, some people would view that as not a good thing.
Okay, how about one more?
Yeah, you bet. This is a note we received from Jack in Lethbridge. He writes, I need some help in getting a handle on the connection between the problem of reducing water supplies, increasing demands, and the majority of solutions I'm hearing on your programming. If we look at the water as a system, then I don't see how using less water to shower, flush the toilet, wash my hands is of benefit. The water comes from the river and returns to the river. Where is the net loss of water? I can see cost savings to water treatment, but not actual water savings to the system. Again, Jack, excellent point. You're absolutely right. It is a closed system. So anything in a municipal environment that we take out of the river will end up back in the river to a certain extent. So what he brought up was flushing toilets, showers. He's absolutely true. That's going to be effluent water. Gray water is going to go to a waste treatment plant, get treated, and get put back in the river to go downstream and provide the needs south of here for High River and Lethbridge and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that you have to remember, though, is waste treatment does take energy, and energy often – not so much around here, but it's generated by water. Electricity is generated by water. And especially some of the ways we use water, we dump it on our lawns.
Yes.
That's not going to get back into the river.
And I think that, you know, in a piece earlier this week, you were saying that really only 5% of the water taken out of the bowl goes to the municipal system.
Absolutely.
And 90% goes to irrigate
crops. That's correct.
So really, that's a small portion of the water system.
Absolutely. And so, but I think what Jack's, the point he's trying to make is, why should I get a low flow toilet or an aerating shower head? Because actually that water is going to end up in the river. He's correct, but I think the assumption would be, if we don't have to treat it, and it's better.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Aaron.
You bet.
In this series, Blueprint Alberta H2O, we've been telling you that water is becoming a very valuable resource. Many believe it'll eventually be more important than oil. It'll cost a lot, and countries around the world will be buying and selling it. To paint a picture of what the future might look like, we found Frederick Sidos. He's the Vice President of Operations of the Global Water and Energy Strategy Team. It's a consulting firm based in Washington, D.C. that focuses on resources like water, oil, and gas. Here he is in conversation with Jim Brown.
What will the water market look like in the future?
Well, it's very interesting, and it's commendable that CBC is taking on this very large topic, and one that's critical to everyone, not least of which in Canada, the United States, and Mexico, where you have a situation where Canada has a huge surplus of fresh water, where the United States currently has a surplus, but in parts of it, there is a projected deficit in our southwest and in some of our agricultural regions. And in Mexico, with a large growing population base and a need for fresh water. So the market, or what the water market will look like in the next 20 years, is something that I can say is akin to how the natural gas market looks today. And that is regional in shape and focus, where it's easier to move natural gas via pipelines at this point than it is by tankers, although LNG tankers are coming online. So you could see water, I think, moving from places of abundance to places of shortfall in regionally.
Mm-hmm.
Canada to the United States, possibly into Mexico, and in other parts of the world where water is abundant, like in Turkey. And then that water, which is currently being shipped to places like Cyprus, further into the Middle East, it could go into Israel, Lebanon, Jordan, Syria, like that.
So you compare it to natural gas as opposed to oil because of the way in which the water would be transported. I'm wondering, though, if you can compare it politically. Aren't there certain obstacles to the transportation of water that don't exist politically when we're talking about natural gas?
Yeah, absolutely. The biggest issue, of course, is when folks have water is vital to everything we do, right? I mean, you can't exist without it. And unfortunately, in this world, there are many more people who do not have access to the amount and the clean and the quality of water that they need. In the first world, we're very blessed to be able to have the resources that we do have. So politicians in places where water is abundant, here in the United States, in our Great Lakes region, and in Canada, in provinces like Ontario and Manitoba, where water is abundant, have very difficult decisions to make, because water is something that is so prized by folks who have it that they're almost afraid to explore opportunities that could be commercially beneficial to them, could solve some other problems using that revenue source. But they're very cautious about letting that water go to buyers who are interested in having it, because you never know. I guess it's you can look at long-term trends as to how much water has been here and what that'll do in the future. But it's very difficult to, I guess, once you start the tap or the pipeline, it's very difficult to shut it off.
Right.
If your farm starts to run low or your community wells or aquifers start to run low.
And then I guess there's the other question, too, the ethics of only selling water to people who can afford it.
Yeah, it's a very difficult situation. And as I mentioned before, probably more people in the world do not have access to water than do, the amount that they need and the quality. So it's very difficult to decide, are we only going to sell water to folks who can afford to buy it?
Right.
There have been, I guess the problem there gets into one of, well, what are we doing now? You know, it's not exactly as if the problem is being tackled head-on now. There are a lot of well-intentioned organizations. The United Nations and the World Bank have tried and have announced this next decade as a decade of water issues. But you know, each government, I guess, alone has to take the responsibility of making sure that its own people have access and are able to you know, have enough water to sustain themselves. So just because folks in the southwest of the United States or in Mexico can afford to buy it from Canada or the Great Lakes region of the United States doesn't necessarily mean that market should not be developed.
Right.
Now because it's impossible, really, to transport that. It's not impossible, but it would be cost prohibitive to transport that water to India, let's say, where there could be some water shortfalls, or to parts of sub-Saharan Africa. In those regions, you have to find a regional solution, which either means drilling for water wells and making sure that the aquifers are not contaminated by oil drilling next door or industrial production nearby, or finding ways to expand and manage the Nile River a little bit differently. That's a possibility in that region. And as well, as I mentioned, with respect to Turkey, that's one area where it seems that transportation of water could expand into a region where it's not as plentiful and where some folks could afford to buy it, let's say in some of the oil-rich states of the Arabian Peninsula, but others could not, let's say in Syria or perhaps in the Palestinian territory.
Right. Mr. Sidos, once again, thank you for your time this morning.
It's been my pleasure.
It was standing room only recently at our Blueprint Alberta H2O Forum at Bankers Hall in Calgary. We gathered together a panel of energy industry people, environmental groups, and the Alberta government to talk about water issues and the petroleum industry. The gathering was dubbed Mixing Oil and Water. Here, one of the panelists, Mary Griffiths of the Pembina Institute, comments on a question from a member of the audience who links oil royalties to the environment.
Given that Albertans are only receiving 1% from the royalties from the sale of oil, can you explain how we're maximizing the economic and social benefits of the sale of this resource, despite the environmental challenges associated with taking water out of a watershed?
I think that's a very good question, and it's an issue which has concerned the Pembina Institute for some time, and we've actually written a report on when the government is a landlord, looking at the relative aspect of royalties. My particular concern is that I feel that Alberta Environment, for example, doesn't have enough funding to be able to do a good job of monitoring and understanding our groundwater in the north. Excellent people at Alberta Environment, but I don't think they have enough resources. We need a lot of hydrogeologists working with industry to have a good understanding of our groundwater and how it's replenished, which we don't have at the moment, and they'll be the first to tell you. We also need to know how much is the flows needed in our rivers for the environmental health of our rivers. We should have, for example, a knowledge of the in-stream flow needs. In other words, the amount of water we need to keep in the Athabasca River to make sure that the fish can live through the low flow periods in the winter. We don't have enough information on that yet. Alberta Environment has set interim in-stream flow requirements when we still haven't got the science done to tell us what's needed in the river. So I think it's a very good question. We need to make sure we have more resources back from the oil industry to invest in good government and wise management.
That's Mary Griffiths from the Pembina Institute commenting at the Blueprint Alberta H2O Forum at Bankers Hall in Calgary. So it's time to put a bow on Blueprint Alberta H2O. For 3 weeks, we've looked at everything from how much water we have to how clean our water is. Many of the stories aired throughout the series point to the fact that there could be a water crisis in Alberta's future. But the other major theme has been that this future is not written in stone. In this final piece, reporter Aaron Collins looks at what we can all do to conserve water. Here once again is Aaron with Jim Brown.
So what can people do to try to help Alberta steer clear of a water crisis?
Yeah, well, I mean, the short answer is lots. As you've kind of heard throughout the series, Albertans use a lot more water than other people around the world. And by making a few simple changes, individuals can save thousands of liters a year. They can make a big difference. And if you multiply that thousands of liters a year by 3 million people that we have here in Alberta, we're talking about lots and lots of water. So, of course, some people, you know, turning off the tap when they brush their teeth or taking shorter showers, that's a good start, but maybe it's not going to cut it. They want to do more. Now, this brings me to Jörg Ostrowski. He's an environmental architect who's been working on designing and building homes that conserve water for nearly 3 decades. And I took a tour of his eco house. It's something he built in northwest Calgary.
Hi, how are you?
Good. I'm Jörg Ostrowski.
It's quite the place you have here.
Well, this is the Calgary Eco Home in Scenic Acres. We don't use the city water. We don't use the city sewer line. We save as much water as we can.
Yeah.
So there's actually sort of two aspects to water conservation. One is lowering the demand. You know, just prudent, judicial use of water, which in our belief is a non-renewable resource. And so we've done it in our own way. We have a composting toilet, which I'll show you in a minute. We have a gray water recycling system, aerators on the shower heads and faucets. And we have a ultra-low flush toilet that anybody can use in a retrofit of their own house as well. Rainwater can easily be used for the toilet and for washing machines, for instance. When people come on tours during the open house here, we always ask them, do you need drinking water in your toilet? And they stop to think, of course we don't. So why in the 21st century are we still using drinking water for toilet waste? It doesn't make a lot of sense. I think rainwater usage for landscaping or connecting that rain barrel back into the interior plumbing for the toilet, that's easy to do.
Yeah.
So I think that is the two best ways of doing that, lifestyle changes and using green water.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome.
So he's obviously done a lot of work here. Would it be expensive to make a house that can serve that much water?
Yeah, it certainly is a lot of work, especially if you retrofit a standard house, sort of make it that way after it's been built. But to create a house that recycled water or used rainwater from scratch only costs about an extra 2%. So if you imagine a $400,000 home, I think that's what most people are paying around here now, that would only be about an extra $8,000 to get off the system and eliminate water bills for life. So that's pretty reasonable.
Okay, well, what about someone who either can't afford to go that far or doesn't want to go that far? What can they do to stop all of this water use?
Yeah, well, some of the things you heard Jörg mention are pretty simple. Things like putting aerators into your faucets, that just sort of throws air out with the water so you use less water. Getting a low-flow toilet, those are pretty easy fixes in most houses. You can also wash your clothes and your vehicles less often, make sure the dishwasher's full when you run a load. Generally, just ease back on consumption. But probably the number one thing people can do is to stop watering their lawns or change their lawns into more natural areas so they need less water. Use plants that are native to Alberta. Alberta is an arid climate, and it's kind of crazy not to grow plants that can survive in this environment on their own. Some studies say water use in Calgary pretty much doubles in the summer, and the majority of that use is people watering their lawns. Now, if you just can't give up your lawn, Natalie Odd of Clean Calgary says don't despair. There is another option, and there's lots of ways to save water.
Get a rain barrel or two or three. If you start with a rain barrel, you're making a huge impact on what you're using as a homeowner. Secondly, check for leaks in your home, especially the toilet. There's a very simple way to check for a leak. Put a couple of drops of food coloring in the toilet tank and see if it runs into the toilet. You can also test your other appliances for leaks. If you're going to buy new appliances, which a lot of people are doing, they're getting new homes, buy water-efficient and, of course, energy-efficient appliances. The standards now are getting extremely good for efficiency, so you do have the choice to use less water in your appliances at home.
Okay, Aaron, how tough is it to get people to make these kinds of sacrifices and changes voluntarily?
Yeah, well, I mean, hopefully you would think people might understand how important this issue is. Maybe this series has even contributed a bit to that. And how important it is here in Alberta to have a sustainable water supply. And they're going to make that choice to conserve on their own. But a lot of people do think that what we should do here in Alberta is start changing a lot – or started charging a lot more for our water so that people have a bit more of an incentive to conserve. You know, hit people where it hurts, right in the wallet, right? Kurt Klein is an economist that thinks we need to start putting more of a price on water if we want people to start valuing it more.
I think we're just starting to understand about the value of water in different uses. I think it's, as an economist, certainly we always look to find ways where we can increase the value of any resource that's used in any activity. And water is no exception. I believe that we can find ways to improve the present usage of water.
Now, we've heard throughout this series that industry, not individuals, use more than 3/4 of this province's water. Is there anything that you and I can do to try to bring that number down?
Yeah, definitely. I think so. I mean, and right now really isn't actually a kind of a perfect time to try and do this. We're in the midst of a leadership race in the Provincial Conservative Party. That's going to determine the future leader of the province, at least for the short term. Now, water's become a big issue in this race. And so, you know, getting involved politically, people can really help put water and water use at the top of the province's agenda. A good example would be to try and make sure that whichever candidate eventually wins has committed to properly fund and implement the province's Water for Life strategy. We've heard a lot about that. But also it will be the politicians that address how big users like agriculture and the oil and gas industry consume water down the road. Don't forget, it's also going to be the government who have the biggest role in making sure our water is clean and safe. Bob Sanford is one of the biggest water activists here in Alberta. He represents Canada in the United Nations Water for Life program, and he says people can help encourage government to do a better job.
You would seek a cross-ministry approach to managing water resources in the province so that it wasn't Alberta Environment trying to work with other departments to convince them of the crucial importance and the length of time it takes to gain the knowledge to prevent problems with water resources, particularly groundwater in the future. A cross-ministry initiative, not unlike what was done to reduce the budgetary deficit, a commitment of that sort with respect to water in the province would allow us to solve many of these problems in advance of them becoming critical issues, and it would reduce a lot of hurt in the future.
Aaron, thank you very much for all your work over the past
three
weeks.
You're very welcome.
And that wraps up our series, Blueprint Alberta, H2O. Thanks to all the producers and reporters who put this together. Next week, it's back to just the best of Alberta. Well, not just. It's still the best material from our morning and afternoon shows in Calgary and Edmonton. Hope you'll be back for that. If you'd like to comment about anything you've heard on Best of Alberta, please contact us by going to cbc.ca, clicking on Contact Us on the left side of the screen. Have a great week. I'm Rod Kurtz.